Mr. W.R. Page, Reel 7. Were there any instances of tension between the officers and men?
No, there was not much tension. In fact, we got on very well together. But the... some of the officers used to be just as browned off as the men were at times. And we used to have what we used to call a blighty period where we wanted to get home. And then we'd have a sing-song, and we'd sing songs about our wishes to be home. And quite often you'd find one or two of the officers would sneak away from the officers' mess and come over to our mess and join in our singing. There's that song, and may I say that I'm disgusted that they commercialized it later on. When I heard it over the radio, it was terrible because it was our song, and it used to go something like... There's many a troop ship just leaving Bombay, bound for old blighty shores. There's many an airman just finishing his time. There's many a... And they said twerp, but we say there's many a cunt signing on. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean. That sort of indicated that we felt rather isolated from the world. They were getting all kinds of promotion and things in England, but somehow or other we felt at times we were completely forgotten because there was no promotion taking place, mainly because there was no change of establishments, you see. And so it went, get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, fuck 'em all, we used to sing and bless them all. And this is how the song used to go. There was the... fuck all the sergeants and W01s. W01s was a warrant officer. Fuck all the corporals and their bleeding sons. We're saying goodbye to them all, as back to the billets they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so...
So it was fuck 'em all the way through.
Yes,
so bless
that's
all.
Right. Oh, where's the cunt going? Oh.
Pardon?
Switch off.
Did the relationship between the men and the officers in India differ from what it was in the RAF in England?
Oh, yes, very much so. I think perhaps it may have been the isolation and the sense of danger out there that the officers in the RAF anyway and the men had got a very close relationship. You were more or less workmates. They were in a different sphere of work, but you were more or less workmates working together. Whereas in England, of course, there was the military set-up more than there was in India. Even that was much softer, I believe, in the RAF in England than it was in the army. There was a certain amount of fraternalism, more fraternalism between the officers and the men in the RAF right through than there was in the army. But certainly in India, the military discipline side of it was very much in the background. Very occasionally did we have any friction. We used to get frictions with the military police, of course, the RAF police. And they were doing perhaps the dirty work for the officers because they were certainly very objectionable at times, and we used to have quite a lot of friction between them and us. And they used to be quite a little isolated group. Used to have their own dining room near their the police quarters and so on.
Can you remember any instances of this type of friction?
Well, there were certainly no outward battles with them, but there was a general disgust and dislike for the police. We felt that they were very quickly promoted to a corporal. They never got any further than that. Of course, lots of us were... There were very few corporals in the RAF. And we felt that they had got this two stripes on their arms and carry them very heavily. We used to talk about their arms aching because they've got their stripes they had to carry. You know, that kind of attitude towards them.
You mentioned earlier that you had a mess of your own for the other ranks, for the non-officers.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how it was financed and how it was run?
We had an officer in charge of the catering, and we had the medical officer of health used to come down and have a look at the meal sometimes. The officer in charge of catering used to come in, and there used to be a sergeant with him, and at some period during the meals he would shout any complaints, and anybody who had a complaint used to get up and say so, but it was very seldom we had any complaints, apart from perhaps somebody had found a caterpillar in their cabbage or something like this. The food was fairly high standard, but this is what used to happen. I remember we had one cook who was a nasty piece of work, and we at that period had quite a poor diet, and he used to make some horrible dumplings, and he used to make them in a ring. They weren't dumplings solid, they were in a ring, like a dumpling with a hole through the middle. And I remember somebody, it was a general sort of joke amongst us that the idea of having them shaped like this is because if we didn't like them, we could fuck them. You know, it was a kind of very way of expressing our disgust for these dumplings.
So your mess, your other rank's mess, wasn't like a club, like the officer's mess in the army, but it was more just like a dining place, was it?
That's right, yes, it was a dining room rather than a mess. If we wanted to have alcoholics or any kind of cups of tea quietly, that would be in the canteen. There'd be a separate canteen. That was a form of club. But, of course, the sergeants, they did have a mess. And there they had their meals, and they also had their bar, and all under one roof, and that was their sergeant's mess. And then, of course, there was the officer's mess. Higher standard still, they had more frills than the sergeant, and the sergeants had more frills than the other ranks, as it were, for meals and entertainment and drinking and that sort of thing.
You've mentioned a little bit earlier about the married men in the cantonment. How did the married men and their wives fit into the barracks life in general, would you say?
Well, the married quarters were quite isolated from our quarters. They had little houses in a little area. And it is recognised that when one of the married airmen was on duty, perhaps in the evenings or at night times, one of the boys would nip down and have a talk to the wives of the airmen. In fact, there was a kind of tale went round saying that how stupid for anybody to imagine that the government would be so generous as to send a wife and all the expenses out there just to satisfy one man. She'd be out there to help to keep all the company happy by being able to at least see her occasionally. And, of course, some of them even went further and made close associations with these wives. And there was a general sort of feeling, well, this is the whole idea of having a married quarters. Why bother to have a married quarters just to satisfy perhaps a dozen married men without... Because it was quite an expensive operation to get them out there with the wives and children, the schooling for the kids and so on. So this was a general feeling that was what it was done for. Whether it was true or not, I don't know.
Did you come across any specific instances of such affairs?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Quite a number of them. And You know, when the women used to go up into the mountains during the summer, I mentioned this. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier. You used to go up into the mountains.
Yes, I think you probably mentioned that.
There's quite a lot of affairs, as I recalled, going on up there. And of course, you must remember, a lot of the women were middle-aged and past middle-aged, and to have young 20-year-old people, lads, interested in them rather gave them a second lease of life, as it were, you know, and they thoroughly enjoy themselves. Yeah, each one of the married families had their own servants, separate from us, you see. They had their own servants in the house to see after the place. I remember I went down to tea once or twice with a sergeant in the photographic section. He had a wife and a couple of children there, and he used to invite me down to have a meal with them. I'm not certain it was in order, but I mean, I used to go down there and have a meal with them occasionally, and they had their servants seeing after them and this sort of thing. And
you mean because he was a sergeant, or because he was married?
Because he was a sergeant and because he was married. Married quarters was sort of out of bounds, as it were, to the single men.
Were the men who had married quarters much envied by the men who didn't?
In some occasions they were. Sometimes you used to feel it'd be nice to have married quarters yourself, and they were rather treated rather well. But I don't think we really envied them, because I think that we recognise the complications and things that were there. And quite often we'd say we'd never think of bringing our wives out here if we got married. It's such a bloody place to bring your wives, you know. We felt that it was rather imposing on the women to bring them out there, although they seemed to be enjoying themselves, particularly in the mountains.
Did the children from the married quarters play much of a part in the life of the baron?
No. We saw them very seldom. They were very much on their own. They had their own life, as it were, in that little part of the isolated part of the camp.
What arrangements were made for leave? Did you have an entitlement to leave?
Did we have an entitlement for leave? Well, no. We used to have a month every summer. And where we used to go to Murray, up to the Murray Hills, during the heat of the summer. And that was taken as our leave, in a way, although we didn't used to have to put in the normal leave applications that you had to in England. You just went up there for a month, and that was that. Because up there it was mainly sports and recreation. There was nothing else laid on at all for you, just to walk around the mountains and football and sport and things of this sort. It was to get you away from the heat for a month. And of course, it was up there where the families, the wives and the children, were up there the whole of the summer. And there used to be dances laid on up there. We used to have dances with the married wives and so on.
Did you feel that the leave arrangements in the hills was sufficient for you?
They always seemed to be adequate for us. I was quite happy to get back again onto the planes after I'd had my month up there. I'd been away from my aeroplanes and my flying for a month, and I was quite happy to get back again into the planes and carry on with my flying.
What special activities did you engage in whilst you were up in the hills? Were there things that you could do there in the way of recreation that you couldn't do in the hills?
Except walking round the mountains, and then we used to be able to go down to the village and hire a horse. A group of us would go off into the mountains trekking with horses. Of course, there were competitions taking place between various units of the army that would be up there and us. We would have boxing tournaments, football tournaments, cricket tournaments between different groups of forces up there. And we used to hire a cycle and cycle down the hill from where we were, and I can't think of the name of the village at the moment, down to Kuhala, which was on the border on towards Kashmir and Srinagar, and then used to come back. We used to freewheel all the way down, and then used to put our bicycles on the bus, and the bus used to bring us back again. There were some of the excursions that we used to have. But generally speaking, it was a beautiful countryside, and we used to love walking and running. We did a lot of running around these mountains for fitness and things of this sort, cross-country running around there. Well, that was the sort of main occupation.
Did the RAF give you any advice about how you should use your leave?
Didn't give you any advice, but there used to be certain things laid on for you, but there was no advice given to you. You just arrived there and there'd be a program made out of tournaments, and you used to choose the things that you wanted to go in for. Obviously those attracted to boxing and football and rugby would join the, put their names down on the list for these things, and then tournaments would be arranged for them.
Did they place any restrictions on your movements?
Didn't place any restrictions in that sense, except they used to warn us not to go beyond Murray, or not to go beyond Kuala, not to go beyond various places. But it was a fairly wide area that we were able to walk around, and you'd pass Indians and things like this when you'd be walking. Nobody would take any notice. I can remember going on one long walk, four of us, and we were standing on the on a bridge that was bridging a little stream, and down round the corner we discovered that was the laundry where all our clothes were being washed. We could hear this chanting going on as we stood looking over the bridge at the water, and we were trying our best to find out what the chanting was, and eventually we worked out that they were chanting as they were smashing your linen onto the stones, black man teak, white man bastard, black man, and there was a rhythm they got going, and they'd repeat this and repeat this as they were hammering our shirts onto the stones. Well, I say that when you saw them washing your clothes, you wonder how the hell it ever came back again in one piece, but it certainly had no ill effects by hammering this linen onto the stones. It always came back beautifully clean and in good condition.
What does tikka mean?
Good. Yes, good. Black man good, white man bastard.
What was your reaction to that? Were you annoyed?
We weren't annoyed. We sort of smiled to ourselves and laughed about it and thought, well, perhaps if we were in the same position, we'd probably be singing a similar song, you know, because it was not a very pleasant job to do, to have to wash all our linen. We were very happy for it to be done, saved us having to do it, but I think that we all came from working class backgrounds, and when you're at home you used to make all kinds of rhymes up about your boss, and that's what they were really doing.
I don't know if I asked you before, I don't think I did, that whether any in the cantonments, whether the local towns were out of bounds, or any parts of them were out of bounds?
Yes, the bazaars were said to be out of bounds, but we used to go down to the bazaars. I used to go down there and buy Fuji silk to be made up into shirts for myself, and we used to go around and look round these bazaars, and they were certainly all right as far. But then you must remember that it was the bazaars near a RAF, established RAF or military centre, was a very different kettle of fish to the bazaars that were up in the northwest frontier. There you were advised not to go anywhere, or you were told not to go in the bazaars or into the native quarters around those areas, but certainly around the well-established military bases there was much more freedom to go around the bazaars and buy things. I used to go get a pair of shoes made down there. You used to put your foot on a piece of brown paper and draw round it, and then you'd go back again perhaps a couple of days later and your shoes would be made to fit. and various things we used to buy. I used to buy various trinkets that we were gradually collecting together to take, bring home with you, and this kind of thing.
Were there many Japanese goods on sale in the bazaars?
Japanese?
Mm. What makes you say Fuji silk?
Well, that was the name of the Indian silk, a Fuji silk. It was called Indian silk was called a Fuji silk. It was the name. I'm sure that was the name. It was a very nice silk, very cheap too, and it used to wash beautifully. It was a more or less an unbleached silk, really. It wasn't until it had been washed two or three times that they really looked beautiful.
You're mainly in Ambala, that is your station.
Yes.
But which, can you say which stations you preferred and which you liked least?
Well, of course, you got very familiar with Ambala, and I liked Ambala. I thought it was liked it very much. I went to Lahore frequently. We've landed at Lahore when we were on our way somewhere or other, and I didn't like Lahore very much at all, but it may well be not having any contact with Lahore. It was a strange place to me. But Bareilly is another place that we went to that was, we didn't like it very much. It was not, it was far, near the mountains, near the hills anyway, Bareilly. We didn't like that very much. No, I think that if I had the choice, I'd want to go to Ambala again if I went to India.
So, was there any particular reason you can think of, apart from lack of familiarity, why you didn't like Lahore and Bareilly so much?
I think that one of the things was there were quite a lot of trees and growth around Ambala. It was rather a pleasant area, although it was a flat sand, all sand. There were quite a number of trees around and all that, rather a pleasing place. It had been well established. There was the village itself was quite a nice little village, fairly clean village, mainly because there'd been some money poured into it, I suppose, by the military over the years.
You mentioned something earlier about the type of servants you had in the barracks, about the man who shaved you and the bearer who you helped to retain his job. These servants would have just been the established barrack servants. Did you have any?
You had no choice at all of choosing your servant. What used to happen was that these people had a kind of license, and they must have been vetted, I think, to be brought onto the camp. And there'd be a group of them who would come on, and then there would be one man would have perhaps six people to look after. And another one had only got four. Therefore, if a new person arrived, he would be allocated to that bearer. So they all had the similar number of bearers. So there wasn't one having a huge number, another one having a few. You know, it was sort of shared out amongst them. There was the oldest one was kind of in charge, and if you had a complaint to make about your servant, you'd go to another one and say, who was the sort of senior one, and say, so-and-so-and-so-and-so is not being done very well, and he'd have it put right for you.
Did the senior one have a special name, do you remember?
No.
Did these servants in the barracks contribute very much to the comfort of your life?
No question about it. We completely relied on them. They made your beds, they cleaned your shoes. They ran errands for you if you were wanting anything that you hadn't got. And quite often, if I wanted something from the village, my bearer would bring it for me. And, I think that it was remarkable, the service they gave to the forces. And very appreciative I forget the figure, I don't think it was more than about a rupee a week. So there's five of you, they'd get 5 rupees a week or something like this, 5 or 6. And quite often I'd give them a bit extra if they had some errors for me. They were excited as if I'd given them a fortune. It would only be a few annas.
Can you say what their good points were and what their failings were? Is it possible to say? or what the men thought that their good points and their failings were? What was the attitude of the men towards them in general?
As far as I was concerned, all the time I was out there, there was very little complaint or friction between them. But I have heard old airmen who'd probably had this was on their second tour out there or something like this, and they always used to sort of tell you tales, and they used to say that all the servants they had out there then were terrible to what we've got now, and if you wanted to ill-treat her, you used to give them a good hiding and things of this sort, their servants. But actually, I didn't see any of that. But I would think perhaps this could have happened. They would give an Indian a damn good hiding if they weren't satisfied with the service they got.
You mean before your day?
This would be before my day, yes.
So these old airmen felt that the standard of service from the servants had improved?
Yes, right, yes. It well may be that it may well be that people who were not good servants were probably not given a license the following year or however often the licenses are issued, you see, to gradually weed out those that weren't as efficient as others. So they probably, by the time I got out there, they had collected around the camp a fairly high level of service.
Were they trustworthy?
Yes, absolutely trustworthy. And quite often they would want to say, "Here, Saab, some money you left on the table," and this sort of thing, he'd give it to me. Very trustworthy. At least my servant was, and I'd never heard of anybody ever having any complaint about money being pinched, except sometimes there would be somebody would sneak into the camp and pinch something, you know, you'd get an Indian had probably sneaked in there during the night and whipped up somebody's something or other, and the servant next morning would be most embarrassed and very guilty about it, as if he'd done it himself. But it was because it was one of his nation had done it against the British.
Did you have a special name for thieves?
There was, and I can't think what it is at the moment. There was some special name. There's been a Sanso in here. I can't think what it is.
What about the way the men treated the servants? Did they pay up?
Oh, yes, they paid up, but they were very sharp with them because they didn't have to pay them very much, and they used to demand a hell of a lot from them. I wasn't in that position, but I know that quite often they would complain like hell. The shirt wasn't folded and put in the right place on the bed, mind you. For really...